This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
After 4 o'clock, Dare to Do is more than an adventure story. It's a story of the kindness of strangers and the spirit of travel, of discovering inner strength, of trying and failing and trying again. What better way to end the second day of the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival than by looping the planet with Sarah Ooten?
Happy days. Okay, thanks folks for coming out this afternoon. It's great to see lots of women in the audience as well. I feel this is quite a male-dominated sort of genre at times, so big up everyone for coming along. I'm going to start with just playing a little film. I've been quite busy since coming home just over a year ago, so please forgive the incorrect wording at this stage.
Basically, we're going backwards quicker than we're going north.
We've just capsized. He came over quite quickly. I'm a bit concerned because water came in and I don't know where from.
I don't know if I'm hallucinating.
Really tough.
It's now officially just me and Hercules. There's no need to follow me home tonight either. There won't be enough space for everybody. But hopefully that's just given a short introduction, because it feels like a bit of an impossible task trying to give you a sense of a 4.5 journey that was full of everything in 30 minutes. I'm notorious for being late as well. I was 2 years late coming home. So I'm going to try and condense it, okay? Mission impossible. First, we're going to go back to the start, kind of where did it all come from? I was fortunate to grow up in a family where being outside was part of who we were. Nothing fancy, nothing technical, just being out and about, walking dogs, racing about on our bikes, climbing trees. And I think that gave me the foundations for just being really curious about the world and kind of curious about my place in it. When I was about 12, I went to Rutland Water, which was really the only feature in Rutland where we lived, because my brother was canoeing and kayaking, and I thought, I want to be as good as him, I want to go at that. And very quickly, as I sort of kayaked both on the water, on Rutland Water, and then sort of went a little bit further afield as a teenager, I just had this massive sense that I loved journeying by human power. I loved the physicality of it, I loved the sort of cerebralness of it, whatever that word is, and I loved how you're just so close to everything that's going on around you, to the wildlife, you're just this curious thing passing through their land, you're unintimidating to people, and it's really satisfying as well. So growing up in Rutland, landlocked Rutland, I wonder if they've got a stand at the Destinations Travel Show, actually, because most people don't even know where Rutland is. But anyway, it was sort of a surprise to me that you could row a boat across an ocean. I first heard about ocean rowing when I was 20 and studying in another landlocked city. And this email had popped into my inbox one day saying, ocean rowing races. Now, when you're supposed to be writing an essay, that's a really exciting email. And I sort of knew in an instant that I wanted to have a go at that. And with the conviction and naivety of a 20-year-old, I suppose, I thought, I'm going to do that. Don't know how quite, but I'll do it if other people have done it. And I thought I should go as part of a team because, well, why would anyone go solo on any sort of journey? That didn't occur to me either. 6 months into that sort of process of deciding that I wanted to row across an ocean, choosing the Indian Ocean because it felt like sort of the forgotten ocean, the Atlantic's a motorway, the Pacific is massive, I changed my plans. I decided I wasn't going to go as part of a team. I was going to go solo. And that was catalyzed by the very sudden death of my father. And I realized that actually the journey needed to be more than just an adventure for me. I actually needed it to get me through that craziest journey of all that is grief. And so that's how I came to find myself 3 years later out in Australia with a little white boat, having somehow earned enough money and convinced sponsors that they ought to have a go at sponsoring my trip across the ocean. I mean, that's brave, isn't it? You know, this excitable young thing saying, I'm going to row across the ocean. I don't have any experience or anything. But somehow we made it work, and out I was. And, you know, all of a sudden, the Indian Ocean felt massive, almost a little too big. It didn't seem quite so big when I was at home in Rutland. But standing out there, I'm sure you've all had that feeling before, and you look ahead and you just think, oh, crikey. And I've always thought that being scared of something is never a good reason not to do it. I mean, unless you actually are going to die, then I think it's very prudent. But off I went to sea. 10 days later, I was back where I started. Because of weather doing funny things and currents pulling me in funny directions, really sort of setting me up for the rest of my ocean career thus far. And 6 days out of Perth in Western Australia, the Australian Coast Guard called me up and said, looks like you're going a bit too far south, mate. Why don't you turn around and come back in? And so that's when I did my U-ey and came back to shore. And some people said, oh, commiserations, mate. Are you going home now? I said, heck no. That was my warm-up lap. So up to the age of 17, I'd never really failed at anything. And I think I was still learning the value of failure, that actually you don't have to call it failure. I mean, unless, I guess, you're sort of in charge of a massive bank or something that goes bankrupt, and then it might have different connotations. But certainly for me, I just thought you frame it how you want. And so I had a hair wash, I packed my boat up with a bit more food, and I set out to sea again. And 4.5 months later, I rocked up in Mauritius, sort of a bit bronzed, a little bit skinnier, and my mind had been blown and it had grown by those months out at sea. My mum was really quite silver when I got back. I'd worried her on more than a few occasions. And it had nearly killed me on a few occasions. But in terms of life out at sea, just totally immersed in this quite novel environment to me, was amazing. And I hate using that word unless something is amazing, but sort of jaw-droppingly brilliant and sublime and exciting. And I think one thing that it had done for me was kind of empowered me to think, okay, well, I've rowed across one ocean and it was difficult, but it was just like any other big plan, really, maybe a little bit saltier. And it also sort of empowered me to think, well, I don't have to follow anyone else's route. I can, you know, route path in life. I can choose how I want to live this. And so when I got to the other end, the first question that people asked me was, Sarah, what's next? And I was thinking, I just want a shower because I stink. But of course, everybody wanted to know, you know, what big journey are you going to do next, Sarah? And so this is the journey that I had been contemplating whilst out on the ocean, because there's quite a lot of time to think out there. I knew that I wanted to experience the other oceans. I knew that I wanted to meet some people because out on the Indian Ocean, I'd met nobody except the captain of a cargo ship who'd seen me naked one morning when I popped out of my little boat to answer his call, asking, are you okay? Do you need any assistance? Or are you just one of those mad adventurers? Yes, one of those. And so London to London was born in the back bedroom at my mum's house as I scribbled on a map. I wanted to start and finish in this country so folks could be a part of it, so that school kids could come and be a part of the start and the finish. I wanted and needed to travel eastwards because I wanted to row across the Pacific Ocean. The way the gyres go, the weather, it means you need to travel eastwards. Really simply, at least in essence, I tried drawing as straight a line as possible. It was the lower line on that west side of the map that I was aiming for to start with. I'd be kayaking for the coastal sections because a kayak is more maneuverable, it's lighter, it's faster than a rowing boat, at least an ocean-going rowing boat. And for the oceans, I'd be using said rowing boat where I could live on it for months at a time. We thought it would take 2.5 years. It ended up taking 4.5. Ditto for the budget. Whoops! I knew that I'd need a team of people to help make it happen. Both sort of from the logistical point of view, pulling strings and things, from the kayaking point of view, because my kayaking skills were somewhere down here and my ambitions were up here. So I recruited Justine Kagenvan, who, if anyone knows her, I think she's the veritable queen of sea kayaking. Various other people sort of in the background, and added to that this wider kind of team of sponsors, because financially it was going to need support as well. Now, besides having a massive adventure, I also wanted the journey to have sort of other benefits to other people. One of those was to raise money for charities. So the charities I chose were Copperfeel, Breast Cancer Awareness Charity. If you do nothing else today going from here, I hope that you check your boobs or somebody else's. Now, there's the Jubilee Sailing Trust, all about accessible sailing for everybody, regardless of physical ability. The MND Association supports people living with that bastard of a disease, pardon the expression, and supporting their families. And then WaterAid, which is all about fresh water and sanitation solutions for folks around the world as well. So there was that. And another important element was just inspiring school kids, telling the stories of life, sort of living a life adventurously and encouraging them to step out of their comfort zones as well. And so I set off on April the 1st, 2011. It was very dark that day, apparently. Oh, there we go. So set off, feeling really quite nervous about the whole thing. It was only that day did I think, oh, crikey, 2.5 years, that's quite a long time, isn't it? I think there's a lot to be said for naivety. And I think the journey for me could be summed up with a few sort of themes, and one of them would be contrasts. I don't know about you, but that's certainly one of the reasons why I love to travel. Noticing the contrast as you travel across a landscape, a seascape, kind of knitting together everything that you meet along the way. The climates, the countries, the people, and so on. Whether I was sort of alone for months at a time or in a city with millions, there was just always contrast to be had. And I think another one of those themes would be of people. Setting out, I always thought that it was going to be the places, the sort of the natural places that would maybe hold the strongest connections to me. And now that I say that, that somehow feels naive as well, because it sort of seems obvious that people to people as social mammals, that actually that's where the real magic lies. And it was so touching and wonderful and kind of beautiful just to have so many interactions with people, particularly sort of this present time where there's all this talk of doors being closed and walls being built, just to meet with the sort of the kindness of strangers, the reciprocal curiosity was really powerful. I was invited in for chai in Kazakhstan. People would call me in off the road saying, Anglichenka, Anglichenka, like English girl, come and have some tea with us. And sometimes I'd leave, perhaps from a little tea house, having not sat with anybody, but I'd find that somebody had already paid my bill. In America, I was invited home for pie. So this lady in the middle there, Susie, she stopped at the bottom of a ravine. I'd just come down on my bike, absolutely petrified. I hate heights. And so I'm standing talking to my video camera, kind of going, and Susie winds down a window. Is everything okay? Yeah, kind of. And I told her that I was really scared. And she said, can I give you a hug? And normally I'm a bit weird about people giving me hugs when I don't know them. But I held on to her that day. And so the next day I've survived this ride up the, I'm kind of carrying on round through the mountains. I've survived carrying on. And she pulls up again in her bus and says, can I take you home for tea? Absolutely, you can take me home for tea. It was wonderful. And in Russia, they lived up to the stereotypes. I'm not usually one for stereotyping a nation, but oh my goodness, I drank so much vodka. So I just spent the night with Nadia here. I mean, just I've been invited to her house to stay. And so the next morning, she's sending me off. She's crying because she's convinced I'm going to die and be eaten by bears. I didn't see a bear for ages in Russia, but she's convinced I'm going to die. And of course, she toasts my leaving with vodka shots. And it's 10 o'clock in the morning. I drank more vodka in those few weeks in Russia than I had done in my life. But I think for me, the idea of sort of connectivity is definitely a theme that came out of my journey for me, and one which I, will carry on championing till the cows come home. So one of my most favorite stories from the journey happened in China. That first few months of the journey, I've kayaked from London down the River Thames across the English Channel to France, cycling across Europe and into Asia. And I met Gao, this young man, in a petrol station. Hercules, my bike, is outside looking suitably cart horse-esque. And Gao came in and started talking to me about my bike. So where have you come from? London. Oh, wow, he said. And where are you going? London. Oh, wow, he said. I'm proud of you. That's a really long way. And he went on to say that he would like to make a journey by bike. But he said, how do you do it? It looks really hard. And I said, buddy, it is just riding a bike. And it's often the way, isn't it? The hardest part is just saying you're going to do something. Sort of take it from that idea of, I'd like to do that one day, to, I'm actually starting now. And so I said, good luck. And he said, good luck. And we went our separate ways. And half an hour or so down the road, I'm riding along on my bike. A car pulls up, the horn beeping. Gao runs across the road. Sarah, I want to come with you. You need a companion. I want to ride a bicycle to Beijing. So we're in Western China at this point, Urumqi. And Beijing is a couple of thousand miles away. I don't know the man. So I was thinking, ooh, not sure about this, but how do I let you down politely, being British and all that? I had a date in Beijing in a few weeks' time, so I knew I had to put a pace on. And meanwhile, Gao had out the road atlas. He's telling me all the places we're going to stop on the way. I said, the Gobi Desert's going to be quite hot, Gao. He said, oh, it's okay, we'll get food and water. We'll travel at night when it's colder. So I thought, well, you've thought about that then. That's not going to work. And then this kind of light bulb moment happened, in that I thought, so many people have helped me on my adventures when I was just starting out, and indeed now, when I know a little bit more. And so I thought, well, of course he should come. And what is the worst that could happen? There was part of me thinking, I don't want to tell his mum that he's died in the Gobi Desert because I haven't met her yet. So I said, okay, you can come. Let's meet in 2 days' time. And Gao said, okay, I'll go and buy a bike. I mean, I already had pretty big respect for him just for having the gumption to ask if he could join in. But the fact he didn't even have his ride sorted, I just thought, that is cool. And so I wrote him a shopping list. Bike, tent. I underlined that a few times. Get your own tent. And various other bits and pieces. And 2 days later, we met. So just take a look at Gao at the side of the road. Can I come with you? You be the leader. I'll be the guide. And then 2 days later, here he is. Isn't that the transformation? Obviously, you can't have any hair if you're going on an adventure. He's got his bike, Now, I name everything, and so I said to Gao, you've got to have a name for your bike or you're not coming. And at the end of our first day together, he said, Stranger. I'm going to call my bike Stranger. And I just thought, oh, God, my heart melts. What a poet. And then I thought also his bum's going to be no stranger to that saddle in a few days' time, because he'd literally never cycled more than a couple of miles before. And you'll notice he's got a modestly sized Chinese flag on the back of the bike as well. So on the back of my bike, I've got a couple of little flags. I mean, they're like postcard size. And Gao's brother had seen those and said to him, Gao, you need a Chinese flag, but it must be bigger than Sarah's. So he whooped me on that one. And I said to him, so how are you feeling? Are you nervous? And he said, yeah, I was so nervous, I didn't sleep last night. And I said, well, are you excited? And he said, oh, I'm always excited. And I thought, yeah, you're giving me that impression. And so we went. We headed off into the desert. It was hot and dusty and a bit miserable at times, because every day we just got puncture after puncture with our tires, because when it's 50 degrees outside, your tires get soft. There's loads of truck traffic in that western part of China, all sort of overladen, tires that probably needed changing a couple of years ago. So lots of sort of exploded tires and all those annoying bits of metal. So we're forever changing sort of punctures and inner tubes and all sorts. But it was wonderful because we were together. It was just great fun. I sort of came to look on Gao like a younger brother, I suppose. And it was really beautiful to watch him go from being kind of giggly and nervous and trying to impress me all the time. So to start with, I had to make him stop to eat, because otherwise he'd just be powering off ahead. And so in those food breaks, he'd be kind of doing jumping jacks, lunges, just pulling up his shirt sleeves to show me his muscles. And I just had to say to him, chill out. I already think you're really special. Let's just think about sustainability. And then he got the message and started having naps at lunchtime. So it was great to cycle together with Gao. We spent 35 days cycling to Beijing. And when we got to Beijing, I put a camera in his face and asked him a few questions. So I'm going to play you that little film now.
This is a moment I thought would never happen. We've just landed in Beijing. Really sad, it's the end of the Gao era. I think we're going to have BGAG, before Gao, after Gao. Great effort from him today, 198 kilometers.
Drive to Urumqi, and I saw you. And my brother said to me, if you dare to come with her and ride to Beijing, I give you the money. Yeah, I said, why not? Just do it. Crazy. Your past is not very hard enough. It's a kind of the happiness. So 1 month, I'm just passed soon to quit. Stranger, like a friend, the first day you just knew it, you should learn to it, you should know it, and you should guide him to know you. That is the first day I gave his name, Stranger. I learned how to fix the problems. So now, we got an older friend. He's not good, really. He's not the best, but he's good. Yeah, of course, but not run by. I just think fly to Beijing. If you want to do something, just do it. Don't worry about anything, just do it. necessary one. I am happiness. Happiness. I can just can use this word, happiness.
Here we go. So there's a little bit of a time delay with having made this video as well. Gao kind of went quiet around the end of 2013, and I just hoped that he was out cycling somewhere. I remember he had said that he told his mother when he got back that he wanted to go and make more cycling journeys. And she'd said, that's fine, but not until she dies. So I really just didn't know what was going on. He wasn't answering my emails or calls. But then I remembered, just in the summer, I remembered I had his uncle's email address. And so I got in touch that way with his uncle and got a phone number for Gao. And one day he picked up. And I said, Gao, it's Potter. He used to call me Potter because he said I could magic anything that he needed out of my panniers. And we had this moment of sort of, oh, how exciting, here we are together, let's have a catch up. And he said, Sarah, I've got a surprise for you. I said, what's that, Gao? I'm married now. Oh, wow, congratulations, that's brilliant. I said, Gao, I've got a surprise for you. I'm married too. And he said, wow, congratulations, what does your husband do? And I said, she's a farmer. He just went quiet. I said, yeah, you can marry who you like in England now. Quiet, 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 quiet. And then eventually he said, well, Sarah, do you love her? I said, yes, of course I do. He said, well, I'm so happy for you. And now we have something in common. And so I said to him, we need to meet up. Let's make a plan to meet up. And he said, well, I'm quite free next month. And I thought, of course you're not going to come and visit next month. Who does that? And then I thought, this is Gao. Of course he will. And sure enough, a few days later, he sent me an email with an itinerary for his trip around the UK, due to land in about 6 weeks. And we were all excited to see each other again. And then just at the last moment, his visa application was turned down. So we still live, you know, with that plan in mind of hooking up and going biking together again someday. But I hope that the story of Gao resonates with you and stays with you for a wee while. So another story that I want to share from the journey is sort of the other end of the spectrum, a little bit saltier and waterier than the deserts of China. It's the Pacific Ocean in 2013. So the next stage of the journey, I don't mean 2013, I mean 2012. The next stage of the journey after that sort of kayaking and cycling across Europe and Asia was to row across the North Pacific from Japan to Canada. Now, this is my ocean rowing boat, Gulliver, custom built in the UK, 21 feet long, 7 meters, would fit quite nicely on this stage. If I was at a primary school, they'd all be convinced it was a massive boat. Even when I say, and imagine the boat out at sea on a wild and windy night. But anyway, I think he's big enough for one. The deal is you've got three cabins, one for sleeping, or three sections rather, a cabin for sleeping, the deck in the middle for rowing, and another cabin at the front for storage. And what a lot of storage you need when you're going to be out at sea for 5, 6 months, and you don't pack lightly. Because the idea is that you don't have a resupply. You take everything with you that you're going to need. There's not too many Tescos on the way across the ocean. So I've literally got everything I think I need for the journey. Pack it all in and head out to sea in the middle of May. And normally, I like to give myself about a month to settle in. So I still row, and I'm trying to get into the best rhythm that I possibly can, given the fact that the weather's really temperamental. When it's too rough, I'm confined to the cabin, and that sort of thing. Only I didn't really get the chance to settle in properly on this journey, because 3 weeks in, I had a note from my weather router saying, I don't want to spoil the party, Sarah, but I thought I better let you know. This is coming. So it's Typhoon Mawar, which my weather router predicted in about a week's time would be in my area of the ocean and thankfully would have downgraded to a tropical storm. But it's still pretty serious conditions. Sort of force 10 on the whatever it is scale, the Beaufort scale, and winds as fast as we like to drive down the motorways and waves taller than this building, sort of 10, 15 metres high. A really serious situation. So we worked out there were just two options. One was to get picked up ahead of those conditions by passing traffic, or the other was to literally batten down the hatches. Don't you think it's always exciting when you get to actually live out a real-life phrase that we use all the time? Yeah, it wasn't exciting that time. Because I sort of looked at all the forecasts and the data and experience of other rowers and so on, and I decided I was going to stay. I wonder if my 31-year-old self would make the same decision. But I decided I was going to stay. I prepared the boat as best I could physically, battening down the hatches, topping up the ballast, getting food and water into the cabin. I wrote smile on one hand and breathe on the other, because I thought those would be really nice things to do in the midst of the fury of the storm. Just for reference, it's impossible to smile when you're terrified. And so into the storm I went, or it went into over me, and I had three of the most horrific days of my life. It's like one of those fairground rides you would tell everybody not to go on. And you know that feeling when you're swung around by your arms as a kid like that, and you're kind of pushed back and it's all quite fun. Well, it was sort of a bit of it was like that, but not fun, just getting pushed back into the harness in my cabin and waves slamming over me like boom, slam, upside down, capsize, go again, whiz round, just relentless for 36 hours. It was halfway through that storm. No, it was 36 hours in. My maths is all wrong. 72 hours in total, but halfway through it, 36 hours. I clocked that so much damage had happened to Gulliver. Communications aerials had been ripped away. Holes had been put into the cabin. The rudder had been ripped off. All sorts of things. The boat was leaking. I clocked that it wasn't going to be safe for me to repair him and carry on afterwards. So I did need assistance. And 36 hours after that, an hour earlier than they predicted, the Japanese arrived and took me from my little boat onto their rather large boat. And I watched Gulliver drift off into the distance. But I thought, it's okay, I've got a tracking beacon. I'll find him and rescue him. And then the lovely Coast Guard folks came and brought me some things that they'd taken from my boat, thinking I might like to keep them. And one of those was the tracking beacon. So to this day, Gulliver is AWOL on the ocean. I did hear about him back in the autumn. He was spotted a few hundred miles north of Hawaii. So clearly he does not need a rower for that journey. But I came home and faced an even bigger storm. So everybody said to me when I got back, you must be so happy, Sarah. You must be so happy to be home. What's next? That bloody question, what's next? Well, I was happy that I was alive, and I was grateful that I'd been helped by those folks that had brought me home. But actually, very quickly, I realized that there was a massive storm that the storm had left behind. The trauma of it, the fear, the grief at losing my little boat, I just fell apart. Just fell apart over a few months, and it took quite a lot of putting back together to get back to a state where I didn't cry at opening my emails, for example. And I think a really good lesson was that idea that, well, we all get those dark storms, we just need to be a bit more open about them. And for me, one of the things that got me through that time was the idea of going back out to sea. There was just that big question of, how do I find another rowing boat when I've just lost a very expensive first one? Well, thankfully, the insurers had insured me the first time. And they paid out enough to buy the sister boat to Gulliver, who just magically happened to be for sale at the right time. The only downside is that she had a really bad name. She was called Socks. And I thought that's something you call, you know, things you put on your feet or a dog or something. So I called the boat Happy Socks, in honour of the amazing multicoloured woolly socks that my mum makes. And we got the project back together again and went back out to Japan 9 months later to have another go. And you can see that I'm quite delighted to be there. I think this picture for me sums up that really fun line that travel, that adventure kind of holds, certainly for me, and I hope for many of you too, between fear and fun. And sometimes it's a bit of a wiggly line and you don't know which side of it you're on. Now, the Pacific Ocean the second time round was wonderful for many reasons. The wildlife was exquisite. I saw a shark, I saw whales, I saw albatrosses. I had schools of tuna 100 strong follow my boat for months at a time. The only downside was the lack of progress. So the first 1,000 miles were brilliant. The Kuroshio current was helping me eastwards. And then I just got into a bit of a tangle. So this picture on the right is a zoomed-in snippet. It's a 100-mile stretch of ocean. It's 5 weeks of my journey. Anyone looking from the outside must have just thought I really liked it in that particular stretch of ocean. Now, you go out to sea with engines this big, and you know you're going to go round in a few circles. You know you're going to spend weeks at a time sometimes going backwards. But the problem is, when you put it in the context of the whole ocean, you still have to have safe in the knowledge that you're going to make it somewhere before your food runs out or before the weather goes utterly nuts with winter. Now, that really crazy bit of wiggling happened about here for me. So months 3 to 4, I'm not even halfway across the ocean. And given that my end target was Canada, it sort of quickly became clear I wasn't going to make it out to our original destination. And so my team and I looked at the options. Bearing in mind it's the Pacific Ocean, which is quite large and quite empty, and I only have engines this big, the options were somewhat limited. But there was one option which looked like a goer. I could land safely, Happy Socks would be safe, and importantly as well, we'd be able to carry on the journey the following year. That option was to row north to this chain of islands, which I probably didn't even know existed before we started looking at said option. So it's the Aleutian Islands. They stretch westwards from mainland Alaska to join the Russian islands heading up over to Siberia. They are part of Alaska, part of the USA. So I hung a left and rowed for another month. And on the left, you see a picture of a very tired and quite poorly Sarah and a very tired Happy Socks landing in this beautiful, volcanic, magnificently striking landscape. I didn't see it, though, because it was foggy for 2 weeks on the run in. But it was a beautiful place to come ashore. It was sort of gentle and quiet, met by people who understood what it's like to live on the fringes. Adak's the most westerly inhabited place in the United States. It's now made up of about 100 people. Previously, it was home to a naval base of thousands and thousands of troops. So historically, it's a super interesting place. Now, I went home at this point and really fell apart when I came home physically this time. I mean, people ask about what's the most dangerous part of your journey, Sarah? I mean, there was the time I went under the bows of a container ship on the Pacific. That was a bit freaky. But I mean, in real terms of actually what has damaged my health the most, it's been my headspace imploding or it's been my immune system totally imploding. So isn't that interesting? The enemy is often within. But anyway, back to the route. After recovering and getting the plan back together to carry on the journey, Justine, queen of the sea kayaks, and I went back out to Adak and kayaked over the spring and summer of 2014 up the Aleutian chain and Alaskan Peninsula to Homer, which is where the first road starts. And that's where I'd be able to get back on the bike and continue on my way. So somebody said to me, "Are you disappointed that you didn't make it to Canada, Sarah?" And I sort of said, "Heck no, I'm going to Alaska." Alaska's the sort of place that you can say with that sort of Discovery Channel, "Alaska," and it makes it okay. It kind of makes it even cooler. And I'd always wanted to visit there. And so to go back with one of my favorite people in the world and spend a few months out there kayaking was more than a treat. I mean, it was terrifying at times. I was out of my comfort zone about 80% of the time, convinced I was going to capsize and drown. But for the landscape and the stories, sort of meeting local folks, local communities who seem to be caught in this interesting situation of trying to hold on to their cultural identity, to their past, their traditions. I mean, Aleuts have lived in those regions for thousands of years. Sort of balancing that with living in this rapidly changing, homogenizing, globalizing world was really, really beautiful. Sort of different stories of endurance kind of weaving in and out of each other. And certainly it was also interesting because The Aleutians is home to one of the precursors of the original kayaks. So an ikyak is what we see on the left there, skin-on-frame kayaks. And people said, oh, you know, you and Justine, you're so hardcore for doing this journey. What a load of rubbish. People have been doing that for thousands of years without all the techie gear. I mean, now kayaking's all but disappeared from the Aleutians. But it was certainly beautiful to be up there. It was very dark when we finished, apparently. Now, I got my bike when we got to Homer, and people were already saying, you do know winter's coming, Sarah. It was the end of August at this time. And sure enough, it did come. It kind of felt like a monster was chasing me before it arrived. So when it got there, I was actually really happy, because I thought, right, now I can deal with you, this previously unknown beast. And people didn't really get why I was cycling in the winter. But apart from the fact I just wanted to finish my journey and get home, I didn't want to have to wait for the summer, it was also really interesting to just see what life's like at sort of minus 30, minus 40, and particularly on a bike. So many people were worried. They stopped to ask if I was okay, such that I had to write on the back of my jacket, yes, I'm quite fine, thank you. I've chosen to be here. And my partner Lucy came out to join me for those few months across North America. I think that was the only time in my journey where I'd thought, actually, I'm ready to pack this in because love is getting in the way of my adventures. So I was glad when she could come out and join in. And then it was the final run home across the Atlantic. 2015 now, it felt like home was just across the water, but said with a rather large pinch of salt, because it's still the North Atlantic, which is a pretty feisty beast. And I knew it was going to be the last time, probably, that I'd ever be alone in an ocean rowing boat. So I really wanted to make the most of it, as well as just get home. I was ready to have a little rest. And it certainly lived up to my sort of anticipation of it being the row to Endell Rose. The weather was quite horrible a lot of the time. I danced with the Grand Banks for weeks and weeks. The wildlife was certainly exquisite. I spent one afternoon hanging out with four sperm whales, two as big as the boat and two twice as big as the boat, just hanging out, rolling upside down, opening their jaws and showing all their teeth, kind of doing this on their tippy toes, like tippy fins, having a little look out of the water, spy hopping, and then doing the other way around and doing that underneath my boat. And daily I'd have dolphins come and circle and loop and twist about, as if to say, come on, where's your bow wave? You're a boat, aren't you? It was just magical. It was cut short, though, by another hurricane. I think they seemed to follow me about. I was 3/4 of the way across the ocean when Hurricane Joaquin was forecast to recurve and come my way. And so 4 hours after getting the message that in 4 days you're going to be in the middle of a hurricane, I found myself on a massive cargo ship, which had just happened to be passing by. I mean, talk about screwing with your brain. That was quite crazy. And so I came ashore in Montreal, and various people said to me, so, you're going to get another boat and have another go, Sarah? Nope. I'm ready to let that one go. It felt like we'd achieved the goals of the journey. Have an amazing adventure and come home safe, number one. Do cool things with kids and inspire lots of them to get out and have a go and raise money for charity. And so I decided that actually what we do is just make it happen the last few hundred miles of the journey in the UK, as we would have always planned to do regardless of what the Atlantic chose to do for us. So we cycled from Falmouth to Oxford, which was really pretty hard work when I hadn't walked for a few months, and then kayaked down the Thames to London. And this picture is from the finish line of me showering everybody with champagne. That's something you should do if you've never had a go. It's really quite fun. And I put it up because it sums up to me what the journey or how the journey happened. I was the one that got to do the fun bits, but so many people were a part of making it happen. There's no such thing as a soloist, I don't think. Not when they've got a big project to pull off. So all of those bubbles and bits of froth coming out, they're all the people, the team, the sponsors, my family, the people who sent emails saying, go, Sarah, you can do this. The people on the road who said, can I help you? Everybody who helped make it happen. And so that sort of really sums up, that really sums up the story, I suppose. And yeah, that's all I've got to say about that, really. I think in terms of, if I could sort of send you away with one message, maybe two, it would be, don't be afraid of new things and don't be afraid of being scared. Just remember Gao and step out and have a go. And then also don't be afraid of changing plans. Some of the richest parts of my journey happened where things went wrong and we were forced to make another plan, or almost invited to. And I think plans are great, but it's only a bit of paper at the end of the day. I think the magic really happens when you sort of step outside of the plan and let it take you. So, that's my story. Thank you all for coming. Good days.
Does anybody have any questions for Sarah? She's the fifth and final event of our day, so we can stay here as long as we like.
Hello, Sarah. We both attended the same school in Lincolnshire.
Oh, big up SHS.
And my question to you is, did those walls of grey give you courage to do and dare?
Oh, sweet. I wonder if we'd have a little rendition of the school song. So, our questionnaire here has just quoted some lines of our old school song to me, asking if that gave me courage to do and dare. I think school was a really important part of, conviction and belief. We were certainly fed, I hope you were as well, but certainly fed that message of the world is out there, go and make it happen. So, yeah, I hold SHS very dear to my heart. Yeah.
Anyone else?
Yep. I was just wondering about the amount of time that you spend on the boat alone and kind of how kind of a change that is when you come back and there's distractions and there's things going on everywhere. Because when I know I really enjoy time when you have quiet time, but and it's quite easy if you're alone in a boat. But when you get back, how do you find that kind of change?
So the question being, what's it like coming off the ocean from total solitude to just the busyness and bustle and connectivity of life? When I did my Indian Ocean row, it was only towards the end of it that I realised that that could be quite a challenge, actually, and I didn't want to come ashore. And sure enough, it was quite the transition. And I think in recognising that transitions can be big and unsettling, that in itself was quite helpful, because then I could say to people, I might just cry randomly, or I might freak out, or I might not be able to let you do anything because I've just spent 5 months doing it all for myself. So there have been times when it's been quite tricky, but with experience, it's been helpful for, I guess, anticipating that and knowing that, like you say, actually just taking yourself off for some quiet time is sort of what you need. I was also really fortunate in that I worked with a psychotherapist as part of the team for all of those journeys. And having a sort of an outside trained perspective on just, you know, helping with those settling in periods, that was really helpful. But that said, it's, I don't know, certainly coming home from the end of this journey, so not just the solitude of an ocean crossing, but finishing in November, I think it was about May when I just fell apart. I think that sort of fallout of, I don't know, the goals, the happenings of everything, the ups, the downs, all of that. So it still can take me by surprise, apparently. Yeah.
Did you fall off your bike many times?
Did I fall off my bike many times? We do have a lovely bit of footage of me riding into the back of a truck in China one day. I think probably the times that I fell off my bike the most would be in northern Canada when it started snowing and icing up, and I didn't have spiked tyres on my bike at that point because they were a little bit further south waiting for me. And there were a few days where I would be slipping and sliding and sort of trying to walk with my bike, and then I'd go and ride along and fall off again. And I'm just really glad I didn't fall under anybody's wheels. So, yeah, that's that.
Hi, how did you overcome your fear?
How did I overcome my fear? Just sort of fear in general, anything specifically?
Tropical storms, going into the unknown. I mean, that was scary.
Yeah, no, it is. How did I overcome my fears? So I think fear for me comes down in one part to rationalizing it, trying to understand and acknowledge that, yep, you're scared and it's okay to be scared, and try and be a sort of a second person to yourself saying, I get that you're scared, we're trying to make this okay, or you're doing okay, or it's going to be okay at some point. In certain situations where I was scared, or for certain situations, I could try and prepare myself. So, for example, I hate being upside down in any sort of boat. So trying to nail my role in the kayak before we went away was quite a challenge for me. But in doing it and practicing it, that helps kind of allay those fears a little bit, for giving you the confidence to think, okay, I can, at least in a swimming pool or on the beach in Wales, roll my kayak back up. When I was out in the Pacific during the tropical storm, for example, and really quite terrified, my strategy was to sort of try and zone out, but also try and be present as well, because I knew that I needed to keep track of what was going on so that I could respond if I needed to, although what I would have done, I don't know. But just try and zone out and take myself to a different place almost, because I knew that if I got too wrapped up in the fear, that I would freak out, and, you know, that could be really even more dangerous than the storm itself. So I guess maybe part of that comes with, is that like objectifying it maybe, just trying to put some distance between you and it? So yeah, I guess that's some of the fears. And sometimes I think you just have to suck it up and just acknowledge that you're scared of something. So travelling through Canada and Alaska, Alaska certainly, and Northern Canada on the bike, before the bears were asleep, I was convinced that I was going to get eaten by a bear. At least during the daytime, I was fine about it, quite rational about it all. And then nighttime would come, and I'd be stoking my fire till about 2 a.m., and I'd get into my tent, and I'd have dreams of being carried away in my sleeping bag and wake up trying to scream but with no noise coming out. So sometimes I was scared and didn't really deal with it.
And we've got time for one final quick question.
What was your diet when rowing and when cycling, and what food did you miss most?
So what was my diet for different stages of the journey, and what did I miss most? I missed fresh food. So on the rowing boat, I'd always take as many apples and oranges as I could with me, and I'd have one of each a day until they ran out, which is generally about 23 days in. But I did sprout seeds, which gave me an element of feeling like I was having fresh food. On the Atlantic Ocean, I also made yogurt. That was also quite nice. It's really simple. You just put bacteria and milk in a flask and leave it to do its thing. So in terms of what I was eating, lots of dried food, lots of sort of high carb, high protein, so pasta, rice, nuts, dried fruit, salami, flapjacks, chocolate. Yeah. Those sorts of things. And on the bike, it would be just depending what I could get my hands on. So quite country specific. I didn't have any cheese in China, for example. So I was quite happy to eat lots of that when I got to Russia. In Kazakhstan, it was plov, which is sort of rice with some kind of sauce and bits of camel meat and things. So sort of country specific. In America, it was lots of hamburgers and pancakes, which I thought was quite great, actually. Yeah. And what did I miss the most? Fresh stuff.
What a wonderfully uplifting talk. I'm afraid we've got to end it there. But thank you very much. Let's give another huge round of applause to Sarah Ooten.